The final investigator interviewed for this program was Dr. Al Benson, who's involved in clinical research in a number of GI cancers, including his role as principal investigator of a critical ECOG trial 5202 in patients with stage 2 disease. Dr. Benson presented several patients from his practice, beginning with an older man who'd never had a colonoscopy.
This is a 75-year-old Caucasian male who had been in quite good health, but presented to his physician in February 2008 with anemia. So quite correctly, a colonoscopy was performed, and it revealed there were two tubular adenomas in the hepatic flexure area, and one of the adenomas also had adenocarcinoma.
Just out of curiosity, had he had a prior colonoscopy, or this is his first one?
This was his first one.
Hmm.
His CEA was increased at the time of his diagnosis at 14. So in terms of his prognostic factors, that would be a factor of concern. His CT scan only showed the suggestion of an abnormality in the hepatic flexure area. There was really nothing else. The liver looked fine. There were no lung metastases. So he did undergo a right hemicolectomy, and that revealed a 4x2x1 grade 2 adenocarcinoma. He had good lymph node sampling. There were 13 nodes removed, and all of those nodes were negative for carcinoma. Other good factors is he had negative margins. There was no evidence of lymphovascular invasion, and there was no perineural invasion.
Now, this man is, like a lot of people, confronting stage 2 disease. He's 75. Any comorbidities or is in great shape?
No, he's in very good shape. He travels quite a bit. In fact, was actually anxious to go back to his home country for a visit. And we had a lengthy discussion with him about adjuvant therapy, and I informed him that his risk factor was his elevated CEA. I did suggest that he participate in the intergroup stage 2 protocol E5202, which
is your study,
right, and is a marker-driven study where we look at MSI and 18q LOH. But the patient was very reluctant to even consider chemotherapy and chose not to participate, but, you know, he did want to have surveillance.
One of the things about colon cancer that's sort of different clinically than, for example, breast cancer, where you're dealing with a lot of similar numbers, is you do have the option of capecitabine as a single agent. Do you think that this man might have considered taking capecitabine even for a modest benefit, or was that too much like chemo?
Well, I do explain when people are interested in chemotherapy regimens, and as you can imagine, this becomes an increasing complex discussion, but I do explain that there's IV-5-FU and there's an oral form of 5-FU in this country. What we have available is capecitabine, and I also explain that oxaliplatin can also be combined with capecitabine for those who need that level of detail. But it is a challenge to explain risk to individuals so that they can make a decision what they feel is best for them. And for this individual, he was not so interested in his risk, but his family was interested that the CEA was increased and is a known risk factor. And they were more inclined for him to consider entering the clinical trial, but he really was not interested.
So what happened with him?
So he came in, and this is where this case was a little perplexing because it was such a rapid change. He came in for his surveillance, which was about 3 months after his surgery, and his CEA was 54. That's a bit of an unusual situation, although, as I stressed, his CEA of 14 before surgery is a risk factor. He had extensive evaluation by CT scan. He had good surgical exploration. And as I mentioned, there were really no significant pathologic risk factors, but nonetheless, his CEA was 54 and his CT scan showed 3 liver lesions. And we then had a very extensive discussion. He was eligible for a clinical trial, but chose not to participate. But he did agree to receive FOLFOX and bevacizumab, and I thought he was a perfectly appropriate candidate. And he actually had excellent tolerance for the FOLFOX-bevacizumab combination. And he received 12 cycles, at which time his CEA had decreased. In fact, on his CT scan, you could only see faintly one liver lesion. And he decided he had had enough and he wanted to go overseas.
Now, was there any issue about the possible resectability of these lesions?
Well, yes, that was discussed with the patient because he had a good response. But at that time, he chose to go out of the country. And what's interesting is I had thought, well, he was going to be back in maybe 1 to 2 months and we would resume the conversation. But he didn't return until a year later. And he came to the office. He had an excellent performance status, had really no symptoms. But now his CEA was 60, and on his CT scan, you could see 3 distinct liver lesions. And so we presented him at our weekly GI oncology conference, and the surgeons agreed he was a resectable patient. And we had the unusual situation here where we had the test of time. He's not really rapidly progressing, so he is a good candidate for liver resection, and this is the course he's going to take.
Now, when he initially presented with the 3 lesions, was he resectable at that point?
He was, but our concern was that this was a very short interval of time. And so we were concerned about what was the biology of the disease. Was he going to be somewhat refractory to chemotherapy? Was he going to be an individual who really rapidly developed other sites of disease? So we felt it was prudent to first give what you could call neoadjuvant chemotherapy with the intent to do surgery. And that strategy, in fact, was successful. He didn't have disease progression. He had reduction of both the CEA and his liver lesions. But the circumstances were such that he left for a year. So
he kind of sort of self-optimoxed himself.
That's right.
So the 3 liver lesions that now were there, were they the same 3 as in the beginning or different?
They were in the same area.
So basically, he had regrowth of the 3 lesions.
Right.
And I guess the issue would be, do you give him any pre-op therapy or just take him to surgery? What are you going to do?
Well, I think that since he had proven that he had chemosensitive disease and he had already had 12 cycles of chemotherapy, although somewhat distant, and we had the test of time, there was no reason not to take him directly to surgery. Now, in terms of what you do postoperatively, if he has complete resection, is not completely known. But I think for this gentleman, it would be perfectly reasonable to just follow him postoperatively. What we do know from the surgical resection literature is that those individuals whose primary was a stage 2 versus stage 3 tend to do better with liver resection in terms of long-term outcome. I think it would be reasonable just to follow him. One thing that is missing from his story, he's not yet had his KRAS testing, which we will do perhaps for the future if he has evidence of recurrence.
So I take it that you had decided it wasn't going to change what you were going to do to get a KRAS initially. You're going to give him Bev anyhow.
At that time in 2008, yeah, that was the case.
So if he presented today, would you want to get a KRAS? And I mean, would you consider an EGFR antibody on him, or you always use Bev first line?
No, currently we do obtain KRAS at the time of diagnosis for metastatic disease. Also, I do that for high-risk stage 3 patients just to be prepared if they recur. And I do emphasize to people that we do have the options for first-line therapy, and I review the two dominant chemotherapy platforms, FOLFOX and FOLFIRI, and then I discuss the role of biologics, both bevacizumab and an anti-EGFR approach, and go over the potential risks of toxicities. And there are some people who choose to hold off on a biologic, and I am comfortable with that because we do have data that both in the case of cetuximab and panitumumab and bevacizumab, that these are active agents when given after first-line therapy. So I don't feel dogmatic about this, that you absolutely have to begin with a biologic. There is, in first-line trials, some difference in outcome, but I don't think it is so marked that you can wait and introduce biologics even in the second- and third-line setting.
When you do use an EGFR antibody, which one of the two do you use and how do you make the decision?
Well, I don't think we have a good way to choose one over the other. And in our part of the country, we tend not to see the cetuximab reaction. So we've, I think, more out of habit used cetuximab, but we also have patients in our group who receive panitumumab. But until we can differentiate between these two agents, if in fact we will ever be able to do so, I think the choice is one or the other.
How do you approach, as long as we brought this up, in terms of dermatologic issues with these two agents? Do you use anything preventively? Do you use things therapeutically? Do you see any difference between cetuximab and panitumumab dermatologically?
We haven't seen much difference in terms of the rash, but we've been very fortunate in that when Mario Lacouture from dermatology was at Northwestern, he established a dermatology program, particularly for patients receiving anti-EGFR therapies. So in our practice now, when we are about to begin one of these agents, we refer people to dermatology and they work with the individuals in terms of interventions such as doxycycline and topical measures. And in our experience, I think the patients really appreciate having that interaction with dermatology. And I think it has made a difference to at least help avoid some of the more severe skin reactions we've seen in the past.
Yeah, the way Memorial scooped up Mario from you, it was like the Yankees stealing the star pitcher from the White Sox. But I guess that was at the SPEP protocol that he developed.
Yes.
There? That was with panitumumab. And were you able to see a difference clinically yourself, not just that the patients, you know, appreciated it, but do you think that it actually had a significant effect in terms of ameliorating and particularly preventing problems?
Well, we haven't had a comparison, you know, with individual patients, but I have to say that I've seen far fewer cases of really severe skin reactions since we've participated in this program. And I think it's been very reassuring to individuals. And of course, this work is ongoing and looking at skin toxicity and how to maximize the management.
Now, getting back to this 75-year-old man, it seems like he did pretty well with FOLFOX bevacizumab. Did he ever express any regrets about sort of shutting out the possibility of adjuvant therapy?
No, he didn't really talk about it, nor did his family. And of course, the implication here is given the very short interval between his surgery and the clear evidence of liver metastases that, in fact, at presentation, he was a stage 4 patient, and it quickly declared itself postoperatively, but fortunately, I think had no impact on his outcome. In fact, he's one of the fortunate individuals who can actually go on to surgery. And, you know, he survived this already over 2 years and has fairly minimal disease, which we can deal with surgically.
Did he have a CT when he was diagnosed?
Yes.
And that was negative?
Oh, yeah. He had a very high quality CT scan. And I looked at this scan with our radiologist. There was nothing to suggest liver disease.
Now, there's been discussion for a while. There's been a lot of controversy. Now, on this man, maybe things were a little bit different. He's older, had that sort of initial question about chemo. But in general, if you have, for example, younger patients who have liver-only recurrence that is potentially resectable, there's a lot of controversy about whether to give them pre-op chemo or just go ahead and send them to surgery. How do you approach that, and where are we in terms of doing trials? There's been discussion about actually doing a study. The NSABP has talked about it. What's going on with that?
The NSABP is conducting C11, which may even now be active. If not, it will be active imminently, looking at neoadjuvant therapy for resectable patients versus no neoadjuvant therapy. And we will get a better handle, I think, on this question. There are factors, though, I think that you can consider in making a decision. Now, first of all, we're talking about the patient at the time of presentation with liver metastases who is clearly resectable. And that's where the concept of neoadjuvant therapy comes in versus what has been referred to as conversion chemotherapy. So those are individuals who receive chemotherapy and then they've had such a good response that they become resection candidates. But in this setting, I think you have to look at what is the risk, you think, in terms of a patient developing rapid progression of the disease, and also the importance of sensitivity to chemotherapy. So patients who receive chemotherapy in the neoadjuvant setting and clearly show decrease in size of lesions, you know that this is a population or an individual who could certainly benefit from chemotherapy, and you might consider the addition of chemotherapy after the surgery. The role of postoperative chemotherapy comes up in this setting also because the current wisdom in a neoadjuvant approach is that we really do give limited cycles of chemotherapy. One important reason is to try to avoid the chemotherapy-induced liver toxicity. And also the reality is that most patients who get a significant reduction in tumor size will do so after about 2 to 3 months of chemotherapy. So currently, I think many oncologists are giving 2 to 3 months of treatment, going to surgery, and then giving post-op therapy. Now, in terms of going directly to surgery, if you have an individual, say, for example, you have a patient who presented with stage 2 colon cancer, and then 2 years down the line now has isolated liver metastases that are resectable, it is a reasonable decision to operate on that patient immediately versus someone with disease such as the patient I presented who very quickly had metastatic disease. And that's someone we really want to know, are they chemosensitive? Is this a disease that's going to rapidly progress? So using neoadjuvant therapy, I believe, it is important in that particular situation.
How do you approach the choice of chemo and whether or not you're going to use a biologic and which one, both neoadjuvant as well as post-resection?
Well, I think in neoadjuvant, I don't feel compelled to use a biologic. It is perfectly appropriate because you are treating metastatic disease. So using a first-line approach in that setting with or without biologic is appropriate. But in the neoadjuvant setting, we want to make sure that there is some evidence of chemosensitivity and that the patient doesn't have rapidly progressive disease. That's different from an individual where you might say, and this is where conversion therapy comes in, that you would like to see the very best response rate you can possibly generate so that that patient may be a surgical candidate. So in that setting, you may choose to maximize the chemotherapy with the addition of a biologic with the hope that you might get additional benefit. In the case of bevacizumab, of course, people have to be careful that if you're planning surgery, you need to discontinue the bevacizumab 6 weeks before planned surgery. But outside of that, I think you have to define what your goals of treatment might be.
Let's talk a little bit about HCC. Can you present your 53-year-old man?
This is a 53-year-old man who had a long history of hepatitis C, and he had been in a surveillance program. He had been monitored with periodic ultrasound and alpha-fetoprotein levels. And then in 2004 was in fact diagnosed with hepatocellular cancer. And it was felt that he was a potential transplant candidate, and he was waiting for a liver. And so the transplant surgeons favored radioembolization for this patient, and the patient remained quite stable, and in 2005 actually was able to undergo a liver transplant.
So the radioembolization was sort of a so-called bridge,
yes,
the transplant type,
right,
procedure. And were you involved with this care at that point?
No. No, this was done by the transplant team.
Any comments about, before you get on to what happened with him, as long as you brought that up, because I find it so fascinating in terms of your clinical experience with radioembolization, whether you use that or chemoembolization or how you approach these, you know, local procedures?
Well, when we have such an individual, these individuals are presented at our weekly liver conference, and certainly the interventional radiologists weigh in. At this time, we did have a trial in radioembolization for HCC, but the interventional radiologists do look at any technical concerns. In our hands, one advantage is we tend to avoid hospitalization with radioembolization compared to chemoembolization. But in many cases, an individual is a candidate for either, and we leave that up to discussion between interventional radiology and the patient.
What about transplant for HCC? I mean, this man had prior diagnosis of hepatitis C. What are the criteria to consider transplant?
Well, he had an isolated liver lesion that was less than 5 centimeters. He was not a resection candidate in terms of the liver surgeon's assessment of his cirrhosis. And given his overall performance status, it was felt his best chance for long-term survival was liver transplantation. If he had been a resection candidate, that would have been the choice for this individual.
What happens when you give a new liver to someone who's had hepatitis C and cirrhosis? Do they get cirrhosis again?
Well, of course, hepatitis C is a field defect. So there is concern about the transplanted liver and risk to that liver, as well as the development of hepatocellular cancer in the new liver. In this individual case, his transplanted liver looks quite healthy. However, in 2008, he developed lung metastases. at that time, we had an ECOG trial, and he agreed to participate, and he actually had a response, but he had a host of toxicities, including some unusual arm discomfort and weakness, as well as a great deal of fatigue. So he withdrew from the study.
I see that that study was looking at bortezomib and doxorubicin. And we hear a lot about bortezomib, particularly in myeloma. What do we know about that in solid tumors or HCC?
Well, our data are being analyzed currently, but I don't think we can say that the regimen adds a great deal for this population. You know, many have been skeptical about the role of doxorubicin, but having said that, we have a recently activated intergroup trial coordinated by CLGB that is building upon some initial phase 2 data with sorafenib and doxorubicin. And so that's a trial. It's a randomized phase 2 and has a sorafenib alone arm. So we hope to get a sense if sorafenib-doxorubicin combination adds much in terms of efficacy. We're very mindful of monitoring for cardiotoxicity also, so that's a component of that trial.
So now, as he went through this course with HCC, with a transplant, and then the recurrence that he got put on this trial, did he get a biopsy of the lung, or he just had alpha fetoprotein elevated, so he just, you know, went on that?
He actually did have a biopsy of his lung nodule, although you could have argued with his elevated alpha fetoprotein that perhaps we did not have to have the confirmation, but he did. And we were assured then that he clearly was a candidate for a HCC trial.
So he got this experimental trial of bortezomib, doxorubicin, had sort of a response, but toxicity, came off the study. Then what happened?
So then he had a follow-up scan in December 2009, which showed that he had increasing lung metastases and his AFP had increased to 5,000. I believe at the time of his response on the ECOG trial, when he came off the trial, his alpha fetoprotein was in the range of about 2,000. So we had an extensive discussion with the patient. He was not a surgical candidate. He was not a candidate for HCC trials because of his previous systemic therapy. So we talked with him about using sorafenib, and he agreed. And actually, his tolerance has been quite good. He has minimal fatigue. He has no significant hand or foot toxicity. And on his more recent assessment in May of 2010, his AFP is now 215. And he actually had a decrease in the size of his tumor nodules. For example, one that had a maximum diameter of 7 centimeters decreased to 4.3 centimeters. And we do know that there have been some responses with sorafenib. Typically, what we expect to see is stable disease, but this man had quite an impressive response, and he's continuing sorafenib currently.
What do we know about response to sorafenib in terms of underlying pathology? There have been a lot of sub-studies done out of the big SHARP trial that looked at this, and particularly in patients with hepatitis C.
I think that we clearly see benefit in terms of parameters such as progression-free survival, but measurable response rate is usually in single digits. So we do know that this population can benefit from the intervention.
What about site of metastatic disease? He had lung mets without any disease in his liver. Do we know anything about how people respond, you know, based on where the tumor is?
Not that I'm familiar with in particular. I think this individual was an ideal candidate for systemic treatment because despite having fairly large lung metastases, he was relatively asymptomatic, good performance status, so an optimal candidate.
What are some of the new research strategies? You mentioned combining doxorubicin and sorafenib. What other kinds of strategies are being looked at in terms of advanced disease, particularly combining sorafenib with other agents?
There certainly is interest in combinations of therapy. So one example is sorafenib and erlotinib. I think people are mindful, we have to be careful of toxicity. Another area of interest is, in fact, this is the ECOG-coordinated intergroup trial, E1208, which also recently activated, which is looking at chemoembolization with or without sorafenib. And that's felt to be extremely important given that we have so many patients who undergo chemoembolization, and it would be helpful to determine what the role of such is. Other strategies in terms of investigation include sorafenib with or without chemoembolization, which is looking at a different question.
How do you handle the timing of the sorafenib when you are experimentally trying to use it with local therapy like chemoembolization? Do you give it during or after?
The way the trial was designed, because there was concern about the potential toxicity with chemoembolization, patients start with sorafenib. They then are able to receive the chemoembolization without sorafenib. And then when they have recovered from the chemoembolization, they resume sorafenib. This was a very complex trial to design, and we had to make sure that the interventional radiologist was comfortable that the liver was adequately treated with chemoembolization. So there's variability in terms of how many chemoembolization therapies an individual will have, but we limited the time period to 6 months. So the patients have to have what the radiologist would consider adequate chemoembolization therapy within that time period.
You mentioned the ECOG study looking at chemoembolization plus or minus sorafenib. What about sorafenib in the adjuvant or post-transplant situation? Is there interest in looking at that?
Yes, there is, and there is a adjuvant study. It is a controversial area in general in GI in terms of adjuvant use of biologics. And I think there's been even more skepticism when we look at colon cancer, when in the case of bevacizumab and cetuximab, two attempts, at least initially, to introduce biologics failed to reach their predefined statistical endpoint. And I think it points out, before we leap into adjuvant strategies, that we have a much better understanding of how these agents might work in humans so that you could have much more solid evidence that a biological approach to treat micrometastatic disease, which of course is the adjuvant strategy, is one that would work when you introduce a biologic. What we've learned in colon cancer, it used to be that it was felt, well, if you have an active regimen in the advanced disease setting for colorectal cancer, that was a very good selection criteria for an adjuvant strategy, because your hope there is that that activity seen in advanced disease would result in a survival benefit for adjuvant therapy. Well, what we've learned in colon, more and more, we cannot use that principle to select adjuvant strategies. And I think the only way we're going to be able to intelligently use biologics in the adjuvant setting is to understand how a biologic might interact with a microcellular population rather than people who have clear, measurable disease as we see in advanced disease trials.